there's so many factors involved that the time is really irrelevant. You know, the fact that you're making it across in one of these channel swims, the English Channel, you know, I think that's the key part that, you know, people need to take away from this. It's such an incredible achievement. You know, I've done this amazing swim. I'd raised this incredible amount of money for charity, and I thought to myself, I've still got some fuel in the fire. I'd love to keep doing this and see what else I can do. You know, when I look back at my swimming career prior to retiring in 2016, admittedly, I felt like I hadn't quite reached my potential in the sport, and I hadn't reached a lot of the goals that I wanted to or had set out for myself and trained towards. You know, for me, it was almost like a second opportunity to revisit that competitive, I suppose, nature in myself and see what I could do and push myself, but also combine it with this bigger purpose to use swimming as a vehicle to raise money for an important cause, and for me that was mental health.
And that was Scotsman Andy Donaldson, who lives over here in Perth in Western Australia and is now the world record holder for the Cook Strait Channel Swim. Andy is here today to tell us all about his Ocean 7 Swimming Challenge and also about raising money and awareness for mental health through his vehicle, and that is swimming. Enjoy. Welcome back, listeners, to episode 32 of the Swim Smooth podcast. It's great to have you here with us listening today. I've got quite an extended interview with Andy Donaldson, the world record holder for the Cook Strait over in New Zealand. Andy is swimming all the way around the world at the moment with the Ocean 7 Challenge, which he's aiming to complete within 12 months. If he does so, he'll be the first person in history to do that. And he's also given his swimming speed a bit of an Uber fish too. So he's setting records all along the way. Without further ado, we're going to crack on into the interview. I hope you enjoy it. Listen out for Michelle coming in halfway through with some scones. It adds quite a bit of humour to the interview. Okay, let's run that tape.
It's the world's noisiest printer.
Alrighty, perfect. And there's my cheat sheet.
It's a cheat sheet. It's blank.
Blank.
Your memory's good.
The blank cheat sheet.
What a shocker.
This is a bloody great start. Along with the scones that have gone missing.
I know. I promise these guys scones or scones, depending on where you are in the world.
Scones.
Yeah. Scones, yeah. We've got our a nice big pot of Yorkshire. Here we go, look at that. Yorkshire tea.
Oh, it's
fantastic. It's got to be Yorkshire, mate. Yeah. And we got but I forgot the scone. So
we can't do the hard-hitting questions. I said, is it going to be jam and cream or cream and jam?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's that one.
No, jam and cream.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Anyway.
Well, gents, it's very, very great to have you here with us today. We're going to be discussing, Andy, your Ocean 7 swimming challenge, swimming around the world, the Great Ocean 7 Challenge. He's trying to do this all within 1 year. He'll be the first person to have ever achieve that, and also trying to do it in the fastest combined time as well, which you're actually on track for at the moment.
Yeah. So far, so good. So,
And also joining Andy today is Jay. So Jay's actually supporting Andy on all of the swims, bar the Cook Strait. And it was a bit of a shame you missed out on that one, because Andy broke the world record, unless you haven't been following it on the interwebs. Yeah, Andy broke the world record.
You can see my face. I'm holding him to it too. The one he's bloody broken the record on, and I'm like, no, the one that I had to miss because I had my own stuff going on. So we had a conversation that I couldn't attend.
But,
and then he goes and breaks.
Well, there's still two more opportunities. Right?
Oh, look at the trend! You know, all the other ones that Jay's been on. You know, read between the lines. The one that he wasn't there. he's been absolutely fantastic, and been there every step of the journey.
That's awesome. Now, if you're watching this and tuning in live, that's great. If you're listening to it later on the podcast, fantastic. Thanks for joining us and listening in. One of the first things I want to go through, I watched a really cool documentary series, if you like, on Netflix a little while back with a guy called Nimal Purger is his name there, talking about the climbing the 14 highest peaks in the world, which he wanted to do within the space of 7 months or a year, I think, but he ended up doing it in 7 months there. Have you seen that?
I have, yeah. So Nims Derma climbed all the mountains that are above 8,000 meters in the world. I did it in something ridiculous, like some ridiculous turnaround. I can't remember exactly, but
I think there's one day where he did like three peaks in 24 hours. Like he just went up, ran back down, went back up, ran back down, went back up. If you haven't watched this, you should definitely tune into it. It's an amazing feat of endurance.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, it's just a great testament to what people can do when they put their mind and their heart to something.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what made you take on this challenge, Andy? Why the Ocean 7? What does it mean to you?
Well, I suppose there was a few kind of reasons why. I'd recently returned to the sport. I'd got back in during COVID. I had a few unfulfilled goals that I wanted to revisit. One of those was here in Perth, the Rottnest Channel Swim. And when I'd done that, I was fortunate enough to come away with the win, which was fantastic. But as an incredible bonus, we'd raised $14,000 for a mental health charity here in Perth called the Kai Eardley Foundation.
Now, if I'm right, you just missed the record for that event as well, didn't you?
Yeah, it was pretty close. It was maybe just about 4 minutes off. So I swam. It's a 20-kilometer race. I swam it in just over 4 hours. Wasn't expecting to kind of come away with anything near that kind of time. And, you know, it was a really stacked field. There was guys there on the Australian team. I was coming out of retirement. I'd been away from the water for a number of years and just kind of went hell for leather at it and, you know, threw my cards down and, yeah, came away with this incredible performance and result. And
it was absolutely unbelievable. So let's put it into context here. So I was actually training up that year. So this is in the height of the pandemic, basically. We didn't know if we were going to have any interstate visitors coming over and doing the particular event and stuff like that. And I think it was in October. I don't know if you remember this, October 2020. It's the first time I ever saw you at an event. And it was up at Sorrento, just south of Hillary's.
Ah, right.
Can you remember? It was a free swim. Yeah. It was a free race, basically. Mm. And I thought, you know, I'm in pretty good shape here. I'll do all right.
Oh, I love when you're talking about
it. Yeah. And I wasn't even in the picture. Like, you took up. There was so much seaweed that day. Can you remember the swim?
Yeah. Was that the swim run?
Yeah, that's right, the swim run. So I was thinking, oh, I've swim run. I've got a bit of a chance here against this guy who's coming back in from. But when Andy took off, like, no joke, you were like, 18 minutes ahead of everyone else over like a kilometre. It was like, how's that even possible? Like,
I'll probably be too kind here. No, it was really good, and it was just this incredible period where, you know, for me coming from a competitive background, it was just great to come back into the sport, and there was just no pressure. It was just all about enjoyment, and you know, I could train up towards this goal of Rottnest, you know, knuckle down, and you know. It didn't really matter what happened on along the way. Like, the end result didn't really matter so much because I was so happy with how the previous 10 months leading up had gone. And, you know, there was really nothing to lose. I was just swimming, you know, with no weight on my shoulders. It was just great.
It was a fantastic result. When it actually came to the event itself, so I was doing a duo with a mate who had just turned 50 that day, actually. Mm. So he was just turning 50, and he's a good swimmer. And previously, he held the world record or the event record for as the fastest team 20-odd years ago, basically. You know, it was still very respectable, like 3 hours 48 or something like that, way back in the day. So it was pretty yeah, quick. Or maybe maybe I'm exaggerating that a little bit, but it was fast anyway. It was fast. Mm. And he's a great swimmer. So we did the duo swim, and I was up against a guy that I know you've done a lot of swimming with, Paul Blackbeard. So he was out there in full of force. And we set off, and we were really happy to come across the line. And I think we did about 4:50. And I'm thinking, that's pretty good. But you're a full 45, 50 minutes faster than that, Andy. And we were training, we were racing together, me and Chris. So
we're just a little bit older now, man.
Yeah. Just for anyone listening who's not actually seeing it on the screen, how old are you, Andy?
So I'm 32. So yeah. At the time, I'd just turned 30. When we got out there on the day, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I don't think the weather was that, the conditions weren't that favourable.
Not that favourable, no.
There was just no expectation out there. Like, I didn't really know how well I was going. I had my earplugs in, and, you know, I've learned now, but stupidly, we hadn't really come up with a way to communicate with each other, myself and the support crew. So I wasn't really getting any feedback during the swim, so I didn't know I was on track for there or thereabouts with the record, and
yeah.
I didn't know I was leading as well. I kind of had a suspicion, but yeah, there was no communication on the day, and which just makes it even more mind-blowing.
Yeah, no,
kind of turned out.
Absolutely. I mean, it did turn out absolutely fantastic. The interesting thing is, I don't know if you've ever looked at the stats which Julian put out over the years, basically, which looks at, based on the average time of people getting across, how fast was any given year for the Rottnest Channel swim? Yeah. And 2021 was not a fast year. No. 2023 was the fastest year on record, or one of the fastest. That's exactly right. So, I mean, to go just over 5 hours in those conditions was
not four
amazing.
Hours, not five.
Sorry, did I say five?
You did.
I did. Oh, don't lie, mate. You know what? Somebody was saying to me the other day, they were saying, because, you know, obviously me and you, Jay, we both broke 5 hours this year. Mm. And he said to me, what do you think kept you going? Was it the fear of always remaining in the 5 hour club, or was it the, you know, the excitement of trying to join the 4+ club, basically? And I couldn't answer quickly enough. And he said it was the fear of not wanting to stay in the over 5 hour club. Because I'd been in that over 5 hour club for 14 years. I did my first Rottnest Channel swim in 2008. So I've been.
But this comes down to the conditions, right? Because you're more than a capable swimmer, and it really is not about ability at all. It's really about the unknowns and the effects of the weather and the currents and whatever else is going on. Yeah, so it's got nothing to do with your abilities.
No, and it's a really good point, Jay. When I did the, we'll get onto your English Channel, Andy, because that's what we're here to talk about. But when I did my English Channel in 2011, the weather conditions were absolutely shocking. When you obviously just recently broke the world record for the Cook Strait, you waited nearly 3 weeks to actually get a swim in, and I was similarly waiting for around about that period in Dover.
It's tough, isn't
and
it? Yeah.
I was with one of your mentors, Shelley Taylor Smith, who's an awesome coach, awesome, keeping my mind sharp and ready for the event. And, you know, leading up to the day, we went down there, and the pilot was saying to us, look, I don't know if you're going to get a good weather window here ever. Mm-hmm. And my little girl was just about to be born, so we had to make a call, and we just had to go and do it. You know, and the best bit of advice, just going back to what you said there about not having any expectations, was I was hoping I might be able to swim around about 9, 9.5 for the English Channel. Basically one of the guys on the other boat, who there was only two boats going out that day, he previously held the British record for the English Channel. And he just said to me, he said, look, you give away any sort of thoughts or ideas or intention about doing a good time here, because you're just not going to do it. You've just got to get it. You've just got to get there. You've just got to make it. You've just got to get there. You're not going to do a quick time. And as soon as he said that to me, because of who he was, and Shelley was supporting that as well, I was like, okay, yeah, I totally get it. And
weight
comes off your shoulders. Yeah. I had a great time. It wasn't a great swim, like time-wise. It's always the thing that people say, how long did it take the English Channel? And it's 12 hours 14. And I always feel a bit of a bit defeated when I say that sometimes and stuff like that. But you know, condition's so important, right?
That's the thing, though. Like, there's so many factors involved that the time is really irrelevant, you know. Is the fact that you're making it across in one of these channel swims, the English Channel, you know, I think that's the key part that, you know, people need to take away from this. It's such an incredible achievement.
Well, and I was going to say, it was a learning experience for you as well, because it was the first one that you did. You'd come off the back of Rottnest. You had massive expectation. At least I saw that, and I know you felt that. But, all that just dissipated after that event. So, I mean, we'll get into that, obviously.
Yeah, totally.
So to
come back off the back of Rottnest, you know, I'd done this amazing swim. I'd raised this incredible amount of money for charity, and, you know, I thought to myself, I've still got some, you know, fuel in the fire. I'd love to keep doing this and see what else I can do. You know, when I look back at my swimming career prior to retiring in 2016, admittedly, I felt like I hadn't quite reached my potential in the sport, and I hadn't reached a lot of the goals that I wanted to or had set out for myself and trained towards. So, you know, for me, it was almost like a second opportunity to revisit that competitive, I suppose, nature in myself and see what I could do and push myself, but also combine it with this bigger purpose to use swimming as a vehicle to raise money for an important cause, and for me that was mental health.
Yeah. Now the charity that you're actually raising money for there, Black Dog Institute, tell us a little bit about that. How do you get involved with those guys?
Yeah, so the Black Dog Institute are an Australian-based charity. They primarily specialise in mental health research. They do research on mental health across the lifespan, so they're looking at not just how to treat mental illnesses, but how to prevent it as well.
Mm.
And with that research, you know, they make it available to, you know, globally. So it's got global reach, and, you know, it's, I suppose, that sort of empirical evidence forms the underlying basis for a lot of these charities and treatments and services that are run all around the world. So for me, like, I thought, that's a cause that I can support, and I'm all about. I think that, you know, when something like mental health, which is, you know, really, I think, quite a big issue in today's society, and is something that can affect anyone, I think it's important that we better understand it so that we're more equipped in the future to both treat and prevent it.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, and you've told me in the past sort of thing, that you went for a bit of a dip yourself when you were retiring from the sport. Was that how long did that period go for you? And do you still have that sort of resurgences?
I think everyone has their ups and downs. For me, coming away from competitive swimming and I suppose not having fulfilled those goals, I left the sport feeling like a bit of a failure.
Right.
And that hung over my shoulders for a long time. I felt a lot of guilt and, you know, that I wasn't good enough. I looked at my friends who had made it and were racing at an international level or racing on the Olympic stage. And it was tough to kind of see. Following that, you know, I found something else to kind of pour my time and efforts into. That was my job, and you know, I did that for a number of years. I was good at it. I'm an accountant, but you know, I wasn't really solving any underlying problems. It was just kind of I wouldn't use the word distraction, because it was, you know, my living and my career, but I probably went a bit too heavy tilt into that and forgot to maintain life balance. I wasn't swimming so much. I wasn't seeing my friends as much. And I was almost trying to play catch up for all these years where I suppose my accounting career had taken second seat or back seat to swimming. So that kind of came to a head in 2019 where, you know, after a number of events, other people were my team getting fired, more work getting loaded onto my shoulders. A few friends from swimming sadly taking their lives.
Oh, God.
People that, you know, were on this journey with me and also targeting, you know, making international teams. It really hit hard and made me question a lot of what I was doing. And I ended up, you know, stepping away from my work to take some time out and go travel, which happened just before the coronavirus pandemic. So I did manage to get some time away.
That's great. Yeah.
And you know, it was a fantastic time. I saw more of the world. Traveled to, I think, about 30 countries.
Which, wow, really? That, yeah. Wow.
Was just a real eye opener.
Yeah.
But again, I wasn't really solving
it. Come in.
Any issues?
It's the scones! Oh, hey! Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Look at that.
And we can answer the question now: is jam and cream?
It's jam and
jam.
Cream.
So here we go: jam on the bottom, cream on the top.
Well, awesome! Yay for scones! Scones! There's about 3 days worth of calories on those by the looks of it. So, yeah, that's awesome.
I've been doing a lot of heavy training, so I feel like I've justified.
We were pulling at the heartstrings as well.
We were, like, yeah, there we go.
Well,
yeah.
We're coming through the story. So, long story short, I ended up coming back to Perth during COVID. And, you know, I was pretty lost for direction. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I would go back into the corporate world or not. But, the one thing that helped really ground me and bring me, like almost recenter me, was getting back into the water.
Yeah.
And you know, swimming. And you know, it wasn't straight away with this purpose of, oh, I'm gonna go swim Rottnest or anything. Mm. It was just for pure enjoyment in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, going down to Sorrento Beach, swimming along the coastline there. And you know, it was just, I realized how much I missed the sport and how much a part of who I am is you know, connected to swimming and the swimming community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Now, you mentioned there that you had a lot of regret for not feeling like you've fulfilled your goals and your mates were all achieving all these things and stuff. Mm. But I've got to say, and no disrespect to those mates because I don't know who they are, but I would imagine not many of them have got a world record, Andy.
Well, I mean, I suppose the beautiful thing about doing what I'm doing now is providing a fresh challenge and an opportunity for me to, you know, really knuckle down with my swimming and just see what happens, put it out there. And, you know, very fortunately, I've been able to come away with some records, one being a world record over in New Zealand at the Cook Strait. And that's something that will be one of the most proud moments of my life.
Definitely.
this is the one that Jay missed, unfortunately. Now, interestingly enough, that particular swim, the record was set in 2008 when I was actually personally contemplating getting into marathon swimming myself as well. So it was probably about 10 months before I actually did the Rottnest Channel swim for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I remember the guy swimming the race there, Casey Glover, in 2008, mm-hmm. setting the world record. And that was 15 years ago. And I thought, no one is ever going to touch this record. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I know for a fact that you happen to take the easier route, is that right, Andy?
He went the opposite direction.
I went downhill.
You went downhill.
Oh, I know. It's just incredible. I mean, when I was doing my research on the Ocean 7, and I was looking at all the record times of these channel crossings, and I was looking down the list and trying to do the maths of what the splits I'd need to hold to break the record, what would be required. And Casey Glover's, I think it's like a 4:36 maybe for 23 kilometres. It worked out to be like 1:10 per 100 metre pace.
Yeah, crazy quick.
Which, it's just absolutely out of this world. So,
I mean, if you're watching right now, we've got the map up on the screen there of all the seven channels. Across the world that you're actually building up for. We've obviously got Molokai there, we've got the English Channel, we've got the Cook Strait. Tell us about and very recently just done the Strait of Gibraltar as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that one's from Spain to Morocco, and it's the shortest one of the seven, sitting at just under 15 kilometres. So that was a great experience. We were blessed with really lovely conditions. It was just so calm. But it was an interesting time because I don't know if you've seen on the news, but there's been a lot of killer whale activity in the Strait of Gibraltar. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen that, no, but it scares the hell out of me just even hearing it.
Yeah. So apparently it was literally a few days before our swim, someone on a sailing yacht had knocked into one of the orcas in the Strait of Gibraltar.
Shit.
An orca, and it's gone and started rounding up the other orcas and
teaching, come on lads, let's go and get him,
teaching them how to knock into sailing boats.
Wow.
So they've been trying to working as a group. I think the leader's called Gladys.
Gladys the whale.
And they've started attacking yachts in the Straits. So for anyone at home, please, if you don't believe me, go Google it. It is just bizarre. So we were watching this on the news, and it's, you know, the days leading up to our potential crossing, and I'm just thinking, geez, like, God, not another thing, like another factor to kind of contend with that we might encounter. But fortunately enough, I mean, I think you guys saw some whales.
Yeah, I mean, I held up a message at one stage to Andy. I said, can you hear whales? Because it probably only would have been a couple of hundred metres off to one side. Mm. We could see some, I think it was sperm whales, the guy was saying, just off in the distance. You know, you could see the water spouts coming out. So they were pretty close. And we saw some dolphins and other porpoises of some description.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of activity in that area. Because, I mean, you can imagine there's, you know, you've got the Mediterranean, what is it, the Atlantic, Pacific?
Atlantic going into the Med.
So you've got all these bodies of water going through a very, very short, tight channel. So there's a lot of marine activity in that space. Mm.
And, you know, just even that analogy, think of it as a bottleneck. You know, you've got the water passing through this real narrow channel. So, you know, you're contending with some really strong currents that are passing through.
You see it right there on the screen at the moment. You know, it really is a very, very narrow channel, isn't it? Yeah, wow. And did you end up spending a long time waiting for that one? Because I know it can be quite challenging to swim straight at Gibraltar. It might be one of the shortest and easiest ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors for that one. So where you actually land in Morocco, they're quite strict on that side. So the authorities... they don't like you going anywhere near the docks and all the harbours, which are built up to the west. So they don't allow swimmers to go unless the wind is pushing swimmers to the east. It has to be a westerly wind.
Right.
And the wind speed has to be below 10 knots.
Mm.
Now, that's a challenge because Tarifa, which is where you start, surface Spain, it's the kite surfing capital of Europe. So
for a reason.
Yeah. Well, exactly. So, you know, you've got to wait for the wind speeds. You've got to wait for the right wind direction. We were told that, you know, if you're out in the water and this is a bit of a funny one, but if the King of Morocco decides to go out on his yacht, everyone has to clean out of the channel.
Wow, so, really? It's just,
there's all these things that are...
This is my body of water.
Yeah, basically, it's just like...
Get stuffed.
So there's all these factors that have to line up before you can even consider getting into the water. And, you know, that's why it's so different to traditional swimming where, you know, you pretty much know, you know, what day... down to the very minute that you are going to be racing. Here you could be, you know, swimming anywhere between X day and the next. And, you know, coming back to New Zealand, you know, when I was over there, I flew across at the start of February and didn't get a swim, or there wasn't an opportunity for 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
were you going a little bit of stir crazy during that time? How do you keep yourself fit?
Yeah, I mean, these are all the kind of challenges that you're faced with. You know, you're away from home, you don't have access to, you know, your usual pool, or, you know, if you get injured, you don't have access to your usual physios or sports chiropractors.
Our physios here bring us scones and jam. You know?
Yeah, I know.
Fantastic. Sorry.
No, but these add to the challenge of what you're facing with this type of marathon swimming. So over in New Zealand, I was very fortunate. I got introduced to the local swimming community over there, the Wellington Washing Machines. And the Spud Buds.
Spud Buds.
So, I know, it's fantastic. So I got introduced to two incredible women over there, Gronja Moss and Sarah Harrow, and they really looked after me. The whole community over there is just incredible in Wellington, and, you know, they've got some, you know, this fantastic beach that they swim out, Fryberg Beach, and, you know, went down there every morning. We'd go for a swim, usually around the lighthouse and back, have our cups of coffee. And yeah, I mean, it was just a wonderful time, and it was very, you know, it probably felt more like a holiday than preparing for this, you know, monster of a swim. But I was just very fortunate. They looked after me. They, you know, even when I got stuck with accommodation, some of them offered to open their door and let me stay. And, you know, that's an incredible testament to the community that we have.
I was just going to say, it really is, because the community itself is one that we've experienced at all of the locations that we've gone to. And I mean, coming back to New Zealand, I mean, look, I wasn't there for that one. So Andy probably didn't have his normal, or he didn't have his normal support structure there. You know, he didn't have that person to talk to or someone to download to. So it's a real testament to the culture and the community, the swimming community, not only in New Zealand, but all around the world. You know, we've had the same one, you know, in Dover for the English Channel, the same one in Ireland, you know, even in Hawaii and Morocco, Spain, as well, just meeting different people and they're they've all got a common goal, common passion, common interest.
They just want to help.
Absolutely.
Which has been so refreshing. So, when we were in New Zealand, the lead up to that swim, it was actually really challenging. I flew in at the start of Feb. Within that 4 weeks, there was a cyclone. There was flooding in Auckland. There was two earthquakes, and
you couldn't write a stronger script really for how's it all going to go wrong before you do your big world record swim.
I know. The swim was starting in the South Island, and there was all these, I'd say, false green lights.
Mm.
So the organizer was waiting for the right weather, and they would send a text like, "Oh, we think that." On Sunday in 4 days, it might be a goer, but wait, we'll confirm tomorrow. And, you know, you'd be sitting there getting yourself hyped up, getting all your bags packed and stuff like that. And then, oh no, weather's changed. Sorry, just be patient.
Yeah.
And it's like this emotional roller coaster. So you have to be ready, but at the same time, not get too emotional or excited because it can be a really mentally fatiguing period of time in the lead up to that swim.
And you've got to keep yourself fit as well, right? Because it's not like you can taper down for a particular day.
Mm.
You've got to keep yourself ticking over a little bit. One of the ladies that I was coaching a few years ago, Sue Oldham, you might know Sue. The oldest, at that point, the oldest English Channel swimmer, female English Channel swimmer in the record books, right? And she went over to Dover and she spent nearly 6 weeks waiting to swim that time. And she's sending me emails and stuff and having phone calls. And the challenge was trying to keep somebody fit, you know, and when she's of that age as well, you can't just keep smashing her in the pool or or even down at the sea down in Dover and saying, come on, Sue, just go for another 3 hour swim. Because she's thinking, well, I might get called up tonight. Yeah. I might have to swim. Yeah. So what am I going to do? And it was very, very challenging. And she, unfortunately, she ended up losing so much fitness during that period that she was unsuccessful in that attempt to try to regain the title, basically.
It's so tough. And, you know, the analogy, I mean, imagine you're sitting in Dover and every morning you look out to the channel. It's like, you know, if you're doing a bungee jump and you're sitting near the edge and you're just kind of looking over, but
you're not allowed to go.
You're not allowed to go and you're doing that for, you know, X number of weeks. It's mentally a real challenge.
Yeah, totally.
But finally, you know, with the Cook Strait, what ended up happening? With that channel, you've got the neap tides and the spring tides.
Tell us a little bit about those, because obviously they affect most of the channel swims that you're doing. What is a neap tide? What is a spring tide? It doesn't have to be the most meteorologically correct description of that. But for the person listening at the moment who has got no understanding of it, thinking it's maybe just a weather thing, how do the neap and spring tides work into it?
Yeah, so generally speaking, you've got two types of tides. You've got the neaps and the springs. The neap tides, it follows the lunar cycle, and basically there's
not less... to be confused with turnips, right? The Scottish,
haggis neaps.
Haggis neaps and tides. It's not that.
The spelling might be the same. So your neap tide, you typically have less water moving through a channel at that moment in time.
Mm.
And what that means is that it's less kind of turbulent out there and there's less tidal movement. So, you're less likely to get pushed off course versus the spring tide where there's a lot more water movement, there's a lot more volume and therefore, the currents are stronger.
Mm.
And most of the swims in the Cook Strait historically have always been done in the neap tides.
Yeah.
And, you know, that had been the way it was always done. The chap that runs or has been historically doing it for, you know, the last 20 years.
Philip Rush.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing swimmer. So he actually still holds the triple crossing record
triple
for the English Channel.
For the English Channel.
Like 27 and a half hours.
It's ridiculous.
Insanely quick.
It averages out to like 9 hours or something.
Yeah.
Up
three
crossing,
times.
Which is just, yeah. I was fortunate enough to meet him over there. Absolutely amazing guy.
Oh, he's
just
a legend.
So larger than life. Just very, you know, very, very lovely chap. Texted me good luck before my swims. Incredible guy. He'd historically always done them on neat tides.
Did Casey happen to go on a neap, or was this spring, do you know?
I think he was neap. He would have gone out with Phil, I think. Mm. So I think that's how it would have been done.
Yeah, yeah.
This year, there was a new operator who'd started up, and he was a chap that was starting over from the south side. So he was taking swimmers from the south to the north. And we were kind of in conversation as to, you know, when we might be able to get going and get out there. And he was like, look, Andy, you've been, you know, at this point, you've been waiting for 3 weeks. I've got a day that might work, but you might not like it. what do you think of this upcoming Tuesday night?
Tuesday night.
I was like, well, yeah. All right, Tuesday. Is that not a spring tide? He's like, yep, it's a spring tide. And we'd be starting at midnight.
Ooh. How much training have you done in the dark leading up into that?
So I'd done one swim in the dark before,
yep.
And that was the Derwent River swim over in Tasmania. It's it's an unnerving feeling.
Mm.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't matter how much preparation helps, and having experience helps. I still think every time you jump into the water at the very beginning, your heart just races. How many times you've...
The background that we've got here is a place that you've swum quite a bit down at Claremont Jetty.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, yeah. We're not actually there, just in case you're wondering.
Warmer clothes.
when we trained up for the... there were seven of us trained up for the English Channel and then Manhattan as well in 2013. And we're all, me especially, very nervous about swimming in the dark. And I remember going for the first swim that we did. It wasn't actually... There is actually at Matilda Bay, and we all went out at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And we swam out and we paused and we like looked at the city, the lights were on. And then Wayne, the train we call him, who, you know, Wayne, he goes, oh, what was that? Something touched my leg. And we were like, oh my God. Like, he said it was really big. It was like rough. And I'm thinking rough skin shark. My God. In the middle of the river. And I was like, I took a beeline straight out. And I was like, I really didn't want to do it. And luckily when I swam the English Channel, I started at 8 a.m. and finished at 8 p.m.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was swimming into the dark, but I didn't start in the dark.
Yeah.
So the prospect of you starting the Cook Strait in the dark.
In the dark. And, you know, I'd fortunately had that experience over in Tasmania, but that was in a river, you know, in an enclosed sort of space versus being right there out in the open, out in the open ocean, exposed to anything. And, you know, I'd heard that there were sharks in the water, so I was pretty nervous. I think there was some statistic that one in every 20 swimmers encounters a shark in the Cook Strait.
That'd be me if I was going to do that one. I know. It would be like the sharks thinking, Newsom, I'm going to have you.
Yeah. So I was really unnerved by that. And, you know, people had kind of found out that I was going to try this this swim in the spring tide. And I was getting people that, we're quite concerned about that. You know that this 5 kilometer an hour relay team tried it a few years ago and they got stuck in the same spot for 4 hours. And,
oh, God, wow.
You know, hearing all these horror stories, I listened to a podcast and the guy who was the guest on it straight out said, it's impossible to swim it on a spring tide. And I'm just like, this was like, you know, 5 days before I go. And I'm just like, oh, it's not what I need to hear right now.
No, no.
But I chat to the skipper, I chat to the organizer, a lovely woman called Jacqueline McClelland. And, you know, they reassured me and said, look, let's just give this a go. And, you know, we really have done our homework. Mm. Let's trust our guts and give this a crack and see what happens. So roll around Tuesday night, you know, we took the boat from the South Island out to the start. And it was just surreal.
Was it? Yeah.
It was just surreal. Like, you know, this full moon up in the sky.
Wow.
Clear sky, just not a cloud in sight.
Wow.
You could see across and just see this silhouette of mountains on the North Island and some windmills over there. And I just, like, it was one of those moments that you just kind of take it all in and think, I absolutely love what I'm doing here. Like, I'm nervous. Like, I'm absolutely scared out my brain, but this is so incredibly special. And, you know, not many people in the world would get to do or see what I'm seeing right now.
Would have the balls to do it, if you pardon my expression.
Well, there, yeah. So, jumped in. I remember it was 14 degrees, which
that's cold.
Is fresh. And again, something I was nervous about when swimming at night, because you don't get the sunlight on your back. So to help with that, we'd come up with some strategies. So we were going to go with some really piping hot feeds.
Right.
So usually I feed sort of 200 mils, and we made sure that it was...
And what does that involve? What are you actually taking on in that 200 mils? What is it?
So it's a mixture of things. So there's probably five different feeds that I'll cycle through during a marathon.
How frequently do you?
Well, usually it's every 20 minutes, which is quite a lot. So for 200 mils. But that's what works for me. I think feeding's different for everyone. It's one of those things. There's no one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
But in this swim, we changed it up to bring it down to every 15 minutes.
Wow.
Just wanted a bit more sort of fueling, because we were going to be burning more energy to stay warm. And because it was going to be pitch black out there, you know, the skipper turns off all these lights so he can navigate better. Because it was going to be pitch black, we wanted more interaction with the team on the boat. You know, you're out there swimming. It can be quite a lonely place to be, and quite isolating, especially at nighttime. So bringing forward those feeds, increasing the amount of interaction, I think really helped in those moments. And, you know, you just ensuring that you don't feel alone through that journey.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was super important. And to come back to the feed, sorry, it's usually a mixture of things. So one of them has Staminade, one of them has a gel and water, one of them's hot Milo, one of them's flat Coke, and another one is ginger cordial and water.
Okay. Why the ginger? People would be thinking, why would you have ginger ale? Yeah. What's the theory there?
The ginger cordial, it's to help with seasickness, I think, and calming your stomach. So I'm not too sure on the science behind it, but I think
it's supposed to be very good for that. I mean, if you look at the
Sailor's trick.
Yeah, I think the Travel Calm seasickness tablets, which a lot of people take, you can have the chemical enhanced one, or you can have the natural one, and the natural one is based off a ginger constitution.
So the idea is each of the feeds have different, they're made of different types of sugars, and so you're not pounding the gut with the same type all the time, and it allows it to pass through and into your bloodstream a lot easier.
And did you have somebody compile that for you, like a nutritionist, or?
I work with a nutritionist over in the East Coast. She's online based, multi-sports nutrition, and she's been helping with my feeds for all of these swims, and you know, it makes such a difference. I mean, you know, same way that you put fuel in a car, you need to fuel yourself properly for taking on a marathon challenge. And you know, it compounds over that time.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be out there in the water for hours on end. So, ensuring that you're not, you know, burning out or running on fumes towards the end.
Yeah.
As soon as you bonk, you know, your times just blow out. It's not, you know, by a few seconds, it goes
massively.
Massively so, yeah, absolutely. I've had a few of those in my experience. Yeah.
You know, we need to have them to, yeah, no, to kind absolutely. Of...
Ooh. You do. I learned mine just recently. I'm like... Oh,
with the ports of pub?
No, that was another story. That's not
right.
When we were just over in Ireland, we did a 7.5K swim. There was no support vessel or anything like that. So most of the people took some gels or some feeds with them, but I didn't. I went, I've done 5K before, no worries. Not much further. So I had one before the event, but about maybe, I reckon, probably about 6Ks in.
Yeah.
Oh, I felt like I just hit a brick wall. And I was... Well, Andy was
Am I right in thinking you were trying to stay with Andy though at his speed? You were in a wetsuit, right?
That would be nice. Thank you, Paul.
But that's what I heard. You're holding a really strong pace, is what I heard.
I was sitting behind Andy for a while, and obviously, you know, after a little bit, Andy took off. I couldn't stay with him, but I was comfortably sitting in second for a long time.
And
a couple of times, my cap, you know, kind of started to come off. So I'd roll over onto my back and just have a bit of a peek to see where everybody was. And I could see myself pulling away from the rest of the pack. But come that 6K mark, I just felt terrible. And then a few hundred metres from the end, this other guy, I don't know where he came from, just went past me like I was standing still.
Really?
All because I hadn't had anything to eat in that second half.
And so, I think as well, the intensity level as well that you would have been swimming at to try and keep up with Andy right at the start, you would have been chewing through those carbohydrates at a high level.
And I was conscious of that too. So as much as I would have liked to have stayed with Andy, I tried to play it a bit smart and tried to sit on his tail and draft as long as I could. But then I ended up on my own and just had to resign myself to the fact of, this is 7Ks.
Yeah.
I've got to stay comfortable here. There's no point trying to catch him because I can't. And I'm just going to blow up and everyone else is going to catch me.
It was just
about maintaining some consistency there. But that was my lesson that day about not having a feed.
Because
normally the events that we do here in Perth, they're a circular type event. You're probably doing a 1.25K loop.
Yes.
So you've always got an opportunity to come in and get some food if you need. But that was a point to point. So... it was all different. And look, it was just for fun, to be honest. I wasn't there to, you know, achieve anything as such. It was just a fun event, but it was an awesome learning experience.
Now, I appreciate gents were jumping around here a little bit and stuff. It's almost like a marathon swim where your brain is jumping around a little bit. It's like 1 minute you're thinking about your food, the next thing you're thinking about what might be swimming around you and stuff like that. But I'm quite keen just to round off on the Cook Strait specifically. And on that point about the Neap and the spring tide, it is my understanding, I don't know if this is true, that Trent Grimsey, when he set the world record for the English Channel, I believe he was on a spring tide there as well.
Right.
We might want to fact check that potentially sort of thing. But what I've, again, it might be an old wives tale, but what I heard as well is that most of these channel swims, most people try to go on the Neap tides because it is more favourable. But if you are a really strong swimmer, of course, which you are, like the strongest, it can actually be a big advantage to be on a spring tide.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I think there's opportunity there to try work with nature. We spoke about it earlier. You know, you can't beat the forces of the ocean. You know, it doesn't matter how good a swimmer you are, if the tide's not in your favor, or working against you, you're not going to go very far. So with the Cook Strait, we were thinking we can maybe take a bit of a banana and have a bit of assistance, both on the way out and, you know, after the halfway, and that's how it ended up playing out. So, you know, I got off to a good start. We talked about going to work in that first hour to try and get out of any localized eddies and currents that were near to the landmass, the South Island. And what I usually do is get updates on my distance every hour. Mm. So usually Jay, when he's on the boat,
but not in New Zealand.
He was replaced in New Zealand. Yeah. But my key support member, Jay.
Thank you.
he'd hold up a whiteboard with instructions on it or any kind of messages. So, you know, distance covered all the way through to things like stroke rate, time elapsed. Just sort of, I'm informed when I'm out there and know what's going on. So in the Cook Strait, after the first hour, I think we'd covered over 5Ks.
Wow.
And, you know, for any swimmers out there
that fast.
Know the maths, 5K an hour is probably about 112 per 100 meter pace. So I'm just thinking, right, we're on here. We go through the 2 hours. I think we'd covered about 11 Ks. And I'm just thinking, really right, don't get ahead of ourselves, because, you know, a similar thing happened over in England, which we can chat about if you want later. Yeah. But we'd got to 10 Ks in England, and I'm thinking, right, we're on here for a record. Like, just keep doing this pace, and, you know, we'll be in and around that sort of 7 hours. But that's not what happened. You know, the tides and the conditions can all change. So in New Zealand, I was there. I was just thinking, right, just keep doing what you're doing. Don't get too excited. You've got a job to do. So just kept plugging away, doing what we practiced. And really with these marathon swims, like I find that I just go into a bit of a, I just kind of zone out and go into this automatic pilot and quite a calm state of flow. So there's not much going on in my mind, but I'll see these updates and that'll keep me kind of updated on, am I on track and am I on course? And I think it was about, I think we would have been about 3 hours 45.
And the record's 4:37 dead at that point.
Yeah. I think it was about 3 hours 45, or thereabouts. Get the sign coming down the whiteboard, and it says, "You're doing great. 2 kilometers to go." I'm thinking, Jesus,
you're gonna smash this.
So I usually swim along, and I'm quite bad. I only breathe to my left, and I look at the boat. I never look forward. I don't say. I just try to keep it as efficient as possible.
But it's a super good point, actually. Just before you go on, like, you know, you've got to, when you're putting your trust and faith into these people to say, hey, this might be a good day to go. The conditions are great. Is you going to be your best shot at doing a good time, sort of thing? And then you've got your paddler who's trying to follow that boat and stuff. You've really got to just let them do their job, right? And then you've got to, you know, so what you're saying there about not sighting forwards, I've made the mistake loads of times of just thinking, you know, I still want to sight because it feels so natural in open water to sight.
Well, it's hard to let go, right? You've got to put your faith in the team.
Totally.
It's completely different to what we're probably used to.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's it. Like, once you do that, though, it is. It's one
it's
of
way
those
more efficient
weights off your shoulders and less to think about and worry about. So, that's it. Like, you're putting your entire trust in the team, and you know, the skipper's in the best place to navigate. They know the waters. So, Grant Orchard, who was the skipper out there, he was doing a fantastic job. And at that point where they said, you know, 2.2 k's to go, or however far it was, I did. I had a quick look.
Cheeky look.
Like, big mountains on the other side. I'm like, holy crap, like, how are we there already? Like, what on earth has happened? So I'm swimming along, and all my feeds are every 15 minutes, and I go through one feed, I go through two feeds, so that's half an hour, and we haven't finished yet. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And then the sign comes down, and it's like,
2K's still there.
Well, it was something along those lines. It was like, you know, 800 meters in.
Right.
It might have been less, like 500 meters in. It was fourth. Anyway, whatever it was coming down to the wire. And what had happened was that the tide had started to turn, and it was starting to push us back out into the Cook Strait, so away from the North Island where we were trying to get to. So, you know, 2.2 Ks usually could take, you know, if you're going 5 Ks an hour, maybe like 26 minutes or something like that.
Something quick like that,
But it was taking about 40. Wow. So, you know, they were just saying, like, have you got another gear? Can you go max? And, like, just all these messages. And when you're already kind of, you've given everything and you've got you're running on fumes, and you see that it's just the most sort of like, what the hell? Like, I can't do anything. But you just, I knew what was at stake, and I knew we were going to be in and around that time. So I just threw everything I had left at the at it. And, you know, fortunately enough, swimming along, what happens, the boat parks up, you know, 100 metres off the coast. There was a big rock wall, so they just got a big spotlight, shined it on a target, because it was still, at this stage, you know, half four in the morning. And you swim into that, and you just hope for hell that you've gone under this time, but you don't know.
No,
you don't know. There's no big scoreboards. There's no Garmin watch or anything.
Because it was very close for the North Channel as well, wasn't it?
It was equally close for the North Channel. Again, 4 minutes.
4 minutes
off the world record there. So I knew that I wanted to get this. I'd do anything again to kind of just get across the line. And so I remember swimming along, arms are feeling like you know, lead. And
right, wow.
It was really quite dangerous at the finish. Like, it was, you know, pitch black.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of seaweed, waves crashing onto these rocks. And I remember, like, finishing and just getting blinded by the spotlight. And then the waves just kind of pushing me back into the rocks. And then the sweet seaweed. I was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't this be ironic if I've just done this channel swim and I like drown here? So I kind of take my time, regroup, swim across to the boat, and you know, the guys are all like, "Yeah!" And I'm like, "How did we go? How did we go? You did it!" I'm like, "Yeah!" And it's just all kind of let loose, and you know, there's words that just, there's no words that can describe that kind of feeling. It's just so surreal, and everyone was just in elation, like this state of elation, even though they were tired. I was tired, but, you know, together as this collective, we'd managed to pull off this massive swim thing that, you know, just seemed impossible, and did it against all the odds.
Yeah,
you know,
so it was 15 years in the making, that record to be broken. And I remember when Casey did it, everyone said, "This is one of those records that's just never going to." It was like an Usain Bolt type of a record where people just go, "It's just not going to be broken." And you know, it went for 15 years and 3 minutes and 10 seconds, I calculated, before it came down.
And it got done in impossible conditions. At night. Against all the odds.
But it was in the easier direction.
Yeah, it was the down direction, so we had that in our favour.
Yeah. All right. Cool. No, that's great. The interesting enough, if we just jump onto, there's two of the swims of the seven. Let's just have a quick look on the screen here again. Look, so the Catalina Channel is still to come. Mm-hmm. Let's just have a look at some of the times and things that we've got here. English Channel, the first one, 8 hours. The North Channel, 9:13. You missed the record, as you mentioned there, by 4 minutes. So I mean, it's still amazing. Amazing swim. Many people reckon the North Channel. Maybe you can give us a review of this after you've done the next two. But most people say the North Channel is the hardest.
They say that's the hardest one, and you know the quick reasons why. You know, cold weather, cold water, unpredictable weather, and the lion's mane jellyfish.
Whoa. Did you get any of those? Or
I thankfully only a couple.
Wow.
Only a couple.
They are nasty brutes, though.
They are nasty. Yeah, yeah. Even so bad that, you know, they're so venomous that they can often derail people's swims. And it was such a risk that we even had a designated jellyfish spotter on the boat. And, you know, he would, a lovely guy called Jerry Kennedy, and I would see him, you know, climbing around the side of the boat to the front. And that meant that, you know, he was out on the look for jellyfish. We'd be, you know, swimming through some plankton and stuff like that. Wow. And he had this whistle, and if he blew the whistle,
you're in trouble.
You'd have to kind of dodge out of the way, because it meant that you were heading for a faceplant. So,
what a nasty thing. No, I haven't taken on the North Channel myself, actually, but it's one that I'd be keen to do. Mm-hmm. Then we obviously had the Cook Strait there, 4:33. Molokai, which we're going to come to in a moment, 15:50, and then the Strait of Gibraltar. So we've still got the Catalina Channel and the, how do you pronounce the last one? Sugaru Strait.
So just for people at home, that's the list of the seven. And just for a bit of context, when we set out to do this challenge, there was two goals that I'd set. One being to try do all seven within the space of a year. So, you know, we spoke about Nims Dharma at the start. That was kind of inspired by him trying to set this kind of time frame to do it. And
I didn't realize how hard it was actually going to be when I started out. It was just, I was thinking to myself, let's try set these really, you know, lofty goals, and hopefully that would try and bring a bit more attention to this challenge, and hopefully that could translate into people reading about the why behind it and supporting mental health and hopefully creating some good outcomes there. So that was one of the goals set, and the other one was to see if it was possible to go faster than the fastest combined time, and that's held by a Hungarian chap, absolute incredible swimmer called Attila Mennyoki. So he
64 hours and 35 minutes. It's taken.
He's quite the guy, and he holds the record for the Molokai Channel individually. So that 12 hours and 2 minutes.
Yeah, right.
And I think he completed the Ocean 7 maybe about 5 or 6 years ago. So
yeah, okay.
It's been.
But it looks like you're on track here to absolutely obliterate. All being well, like the combined time, I was thinking about 45-50 hours.
We'd set some lofty targets. I think it's we were on track for around 50, but this probably leads well into Molokai. Molokai perhaps didn't go to plan in terms of time. And
what happened there? What?
Well, it was just a real ocean swim, I suppose. You know, so we got out there, we had our swim organized for April, and we'd actually ended up delaying flying out there because Mike Twig Smith, he was the skipper and the organizer, I think it was maybe about 3 days before we were supposed to fly out, he just said, don't come right now, trade winds coming in. They won't settle for about 10 days.
Wow.
So we're like, all right, okay. So we hurriedly tried to change our flights, cancel our accommodation. And you know, we were just sitting in Perth waiting for a message and for an update from him. And so, you know, we kept in touch. We'd speak every odd day. And maybe after about 10 days, he was like, look, I think we might have a day you know, in 4 days, can you get out now? So that's what we did. We rushed, looked at getting some flights, and flew out to Hawaii. So we flew out, I think, on the Saturday morning, got there on the Saturday morning as well, because you passed the international
deadline. Of course, yeah. Go back in time. Yeah.
And you go back in time, and we arrived there, met Mike.
Yeah, I think we landed at 10:30. We met Mike at, was it 6 or 5 or something?
Five or six in the afternoon. All right, guys, let's go tomorrow.
Oh, really?
I'm just like, geez.
So both of us are walking.
It's almost as nasty hearing that as knowing that you might wait 3 weeks. Yeah. I think.
Well, and we didn't get to sleep all that well on the flight. You know, I reckon that was probably the most nervous time for both of us. I mean, we were both walking around Hawaii, like after we'd landed and got our accommodation and before we met Mike, we were both walking around just trying to enjoy the day and just settle in. And I think we didn't have this conversation before, but afterwards we both kind of realized that we didn't want to be there. We didn't enjoy it. We weren't having fun because it was quite a stressful lead up.
Yeah.
We couldn't really appreciate how nice Hawaii and Oahu was. Like, yeah, we were there and we were just really salty moods. And
yeah.
You know, we hadn't had this chance to settle in. We hadn't had the ideal preparation. And Mike's like, right, we can either chance our luck and go tomorrow, or, you know, I don't think we'll get to go. So, you know, we've got this schedule of trying to do all 7 of the Ocean 7s within the space of a year, and we couldn't really afford not to take those chances. No. So we thought, right, we'll give it a crack. And so what happens over there, the main island is Oahu, but you start over in Molokai. So a lot of swimmers will fly over earlier in the day of their swim. The swims tend to start in the evening, and people swim through the night to try. That's when it's meant to be calmest with the winds. So people will fly across, take a taxi over to the coast, and then they'll usually meet the skipper who's taking the boat from Oahu over to Molokai. But we didn't really have that time to plan and prepare that. So we ended up going across with Mike on the boat instead of flying. And so we're on the boat. It's probably about 3 hours. And for anyone that's been to Hawaii, I mean, there's a reason why all the surfing
competitions just thinking exactly that. Wow.
It's two a few little pinheads of land in the middle of
middle of the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, we're out there on the boat and it's just going.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it was a really calm day. The water was quite glassy, but the swell was
rolling. And you know, like when you're on a boat and you're trying to go to the toilet and you just you just can't go. Like I think I stood trying to pee for about 20 minutes.
Wow.
But, you know, this three-hour journey across, like, I'm not terribly good on boats. So I was pretty nauseous through that whole time. And, you know, we get across to Molokai, feeling a bit dizzy. And I'm about to embark on this 45-kilometer swim. So the preparation's all kind of blown out and, you know, It was just some challenge that we had to, you know, accept it wasn't ideal and just, you know, move forward. So Well, when we started, you know, it was like this tropical paradise island. It was just beautiful, gorgeous.
Yeah,
you know, sun was coming down. I started swimming off the beach into the sunset, and you know, it couldn't have been more idyllic. And what happens in Molokai?
Calm before the storm.
Yes. So it was the calm before the storm. So what happens in Molokai? You have the boat and it doesn't stay next to the swimmer.
Right.
So the boat stays out maybe 100, 200 meters in front and you are sitting next to a kayaker.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, you know, if you were sitting beside the boat, the swell is so strong that it will probably sweep the boat into the swimmer and it's not safe. So they sit out there and try to hold on to the rum line, which is the most direct point from A to B. And you're there with a kayaker. So we're setting off. You know, I thought it was quite calm, swimming along, sun goes down. And usually my pace is around sort of the 5 kilometer mark. So that's I suppose my...
That's mega quick if you're listening in. mega quick. 112.
He says it so calmly too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what I've done my training for. And,
yeah.
In this instance, I knew I probably couldn't hold 5Ks for, you know, that period of time. So we went a little bit lighter.
Mm.
But I remember getting the first update from Jay on the whiteboard of distance covered, and I think it was something like 4Ks.
Ah,
and it just, you know, I was like, all right, okay, maybe it's just you know, some strong currents to begin with that are just near to Molokai.
Yeah,
let's just see what happens. So keep going, get the second update at 2 hours. 7 kilometers, so I've only covered 3Ks in the next one. And I'm thinking, oh geez, that's not ideal. So thankfully Jay kind of wrote down on a message like head on currents.
It's so important to hear that from the support.
And we expected some of that as well. I mean, because it's such a long distance between the two islands, you kind of expect to hit some turbulence along the way. Like, it's not always going to be smooth sailing. It was kind of expected. So anyway,
And it it's not ideal news, but it puts to rest any
doubt that you got in yourself.
Self-doubt. It's not anything I'm doing wrong.
No.
It's just unfortunately the hand that we've been dealt.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was preparing myself and instantly my head's thinking, right, I'm probably going to be out here a bit longer than what I was hoping for or what I'd like. And that's okay. You know, that's an unfortunate thing, or not an unfortunate thing, it's what to expect with marathon swimming and channel swimming. Like, we're out there in the ocean and there's all these factors that are outside of our control. So,
do you know what? Funnily enough, I had somebody for a one-to-one video analysis session this week. He's done two Rottnest solo swims. He did 2022 and 2023. Mm. 2022, he did 6.5 hours, I think. 2023, he went 5:58 or 5:55 or something. Mm. And he's actually disappointed about the second one because he felt like he actually didn't perform as well. And I said, yeah, but whenever you, anybody else ever asks you what time you swam, yeah. you'll tell them your fastest is 5:55. And they go, that's great. That's an amazing swim sort of thing. He said, yeah, but in my heart, I still feel the 6.5 was the better swim.
Yeah. It's interesting that. So I think it's so important people know that you know, it's not... It is an ego thing. Like, you want to obviously go across these things as fast as possible, but there's so many contributing factors to time that, you know, you can't focus too much or get too bogged down.
And it's never a level playing field out there because every day is different. Every piece of water that you go in is different. The current, the temperatures, the waves, the wind, everything.
I was looking at a little bit of old footage yesterday of, it was literally 4 or 5 days before I swam the English Channel myself. And I was in prime condition. I was really fat because I'd probably eaten all of those, those scones there. I was really, really fat, ready for it. And the weather was just looking really, really crap. And I had a friend call me up, a guy who used to be my sports physiologist when I was going through British Triathlon, a guy called Professor Greg White. And he's the coach of David Walliams, the kids' author, and a Little Britain comedian. And he said, look, David Walliams is swimming down the length of the Thames this week, 8 days, non-continuous basically. Stop each night basically, but he was trying to do it as best he possibly could. Amazing. Would you come along and swim with him? And I was like, yeah, fantastic. What an opportunity. So I went, I swam day two with him. And no disrespect to Dave Walliams at all, because
what he's doing is amazing.
But I was in there thinking, this guy has swum 10 and a half hours for the English Channel, and we were swimming very, very slow down the Thames. And you know, I was only doing one day with him. He was doing eight, and he ended up on that day, ended up getting like major dysentery as well. So he was doing a good job in bad conditions for holding together. But I remember thinking, wow, this is quite a steady pace sort of thing. And then literally 4 or 5 days later, I went and did the English Channel, and it's 1:45 slower than the time that he'd done. It does put it into
it
perspective.
Messes with your mind.
It does mess with your mind.
I mean, Molokai is a great example. There was a chap who went, I think, 3 weeks before we did, and went 12 hours something. For reference, the record is 12:02, and I think this was his first ever marathon swim.
Wow!
You know, I'm just thinking, I wish I was out there on that day. You know,
there's definitely a bit of envy that builds.
We didn't come anywhere near that. So we were out there. You know, I was plunging away through the night, and it was quite disorientating. You know, you don't have the boat there. One of the times the paddlers didn't actually have any lights on them, so I could just see the silhouette of someone. So it was so lonely at times. But again, it's up to you how you kind of choose to receive that. And I tried to stay positive and, you know, remind myself how lucky I was. I would look up at the stars and just
You had the luminescence in the water as well.
In the water. There was one point where some dolphins came along and accompanied, which was quite surreal. And
even that would freak me out.
Not long after, there was a sort of grey thing under the water.
Oh my god!
And I was telling myself, I was like, just wait a second. You'll hear the dolphin screeches, and they didn't come. The longer it went, I was like, this thing is kind of stalking. I'm like, that's not a dolphin.
Yeah, wow. Oh, my God. That's
I know, but, you know, in those moments, like, what can you do? Like, you're so out of your comfort zone. There's nothing within your control that you can do there.
No.
The boat's 200 meters away and you've got a kayaker beside you, so you can't exactly, like,
jump on that.
Push the kayaker off.
And for reference, the kayaker does have shark shields on it as well. There was a procedure if there was something to happen.
And that's, where Jay's, what Jay's mentioned there, the kayaker had these two shark shields kind of dangled into the water. So that's what I did.
Did you ever swim into them?
I swam right up beside the kayak.
Yeah.
I was like, staying as close to them as possible.
He was moving away from me, wasn't he?
And so that's what happened. I think he just thought I was going off center, so he just kind of moved away. Oh no!
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the sort of grey thing is stuck around for, well, I think it might have been only about 5 minutes, but it felt like an eternity.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, like, luckily we pushed through that and, you know, we were...
Did you bump into the shark shield at all? Because I've done that.
Yeah. And it gives you that kind of snap.
Yeah, it's a horrible feeling.
Nice, is it? It's like...
Yeah. 2015 Rottnest Channel Swim was a really rough year, and I swam with a shark shield on the back of the kayak.
Yeah.
It kept zapping me. Oh. And you know you're about to get zapped because you can feel your teeth almost rattling tight in your gums, and then boom, and your whole body just goes. it was shocking.
But what's the alternative? Like, I don't want to be. I don't want to lose a limb. You know.
No, that's right.
But that swim was...
So how much did this swim take out of you then? When you're in there for 15 hours and 50 minutes. So how long did it take you to recover from that?
A long time, and not just physically. It was more mentally. Mm. So what ended up happening, we were still going okay. We were tracking okay. I think we were maybe around the 10-hour mark when we had 10Ks to go. And that would normally take sort of 2 hours.
Mm.
It took 6 hours.
Gee, wow.
It took 6 hours to do that last 10K. And, oh, my God. You know, the pace. Wow.
And just to put that into context, so the Rottnest Channel Swim, which you've won in just over 4 hours, nearly broke the record for it, they have a qualifying criteria, which is 4 hours and 15 minutes to swim a 10K to qualify for the Rottnest Channel Swim. And, you know, that's actually it's not super generous. Like, it still keeps people, you know, it sort of definitely funnels people's attention, let's say, to actually be able to qualify for it. But 4 hours, 15, and it took you 6 hours to do that last 10.
Well, wow. and that was it. The skipper decided to change course. So for anyone that has Strava, there's the Strava maps on there, and you can see that we're just getting...
So that proves you actually swam it then?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if it didn't happen on Strava,
I've got a post about it. But if you look at the map, it's like spaghetti. Like, it's like a kid's drawing a straight line, and it's just like this.
Wow.
You know, and we're getting pushed to the side, pushed off course. It was never a straight line. And so we ended up going north to try and get out of this head-on current.
And I'll just jump in here. So Andy's not aware of any of this, right? Because he's been in the water for, I don't know, 10 hours or more at that stage. So there was some communication with the skipper as well in terms of what was going on, and the wind and the conditions were always kind of forecast to pick up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But what we were unawares of is that the forecast had actually changed and we were swimming into a storm.
Oh, my God.
So when we didn't know that before we set off. So this just became apparent as we were out there. So Andy doesn't know any of this.
Wow.
And, you know, his recollection or, you know, his understanding of what happened was because the conditions changed so much, we were getting pushed northerly. And there's a couple of locations where you can land at Hawaii. So we were trying to get around to the northern point. But as we were getting closer, the current's pushing him south now.
Wow.
So then we changed tact again.
So the wind is... going in the opposite direction of the current, and it's just creating all this really turbulent water. And, you know, the wind speeds picked up, like Jay was saying, we were swimming into the start of a storm. The wind speed picked up to about, I think, 25 knots, almost with gusts of probably 35. And the swells were about 2 or 3 meters. So it was just like a washing machine out there. I was like a rag doll just getting thrown about. And you know, the guys are doing their best. I'm already exhausted at this point. The guys are doing their best to kind of keep me encouraged. They're sending in people are sending in messages from around the world, family and friends, and they're writing it on the whiteboard. But like the news, like it was just bad news after bad news. You know, finding out that in the last 2 hours, you've only swum 3 kilometers. You know, for anyone, I've done the maths. It's taking 4 minutes to do 100 meters.
Wow.
4 minutes to do 100 meters. And to receive that sort of news when, you know, you've got nothing left in the tank, you're already exhausted, you've been out there in the water for 12, 13 hours, it's nothing can prepare you for that. Nothing can prepare you for those moments, and you know, We talked about it earlier. What's the hardest challenge or channel of this Ocean Sevens? And you know, a lot of people think or say the North Channel, and I agree, it's a really tough swim. But you can prepare for the cold.
You can prepare
for the jellyfish and all these different things. But you can't prepare for that psychological battering unless you've experienced it. And that was, you know, a real litmus test out there. Like, I'd never experienced anything. I thought, I was quite a tough guy and I'd experienced stuff before, but it was nothing like that.
Yeah, wow.
You know, where you're really fighting, just get one more arm over. And, you know, when you find out that you're only going...
Four minutes of 100.
Oh, sometimes the messages would come up and he's only travelled 500 metres. I'm sitting there. And even from a support perspective, like psychologically, we're trying to keep him engaged and motivated.
Totally.
And the information comes from the skipper and I'm like, oh, I can't tell him that. Like, that's just going to demoralise him.
So we're trying to get to this beach, Alan Davis Beach, and the guys are like, right, you've got 1K to go or 2Ks to go. And we're swimming along. But the currents had started pushing us south and it got to the stage where we could no longer get to that beach. So I'm swimming along and I can see the land. I can see the finish, but we're just going parallel to it. And so I'm shouting up to the guys, like, what the hell's going on? Like,
we're literally having an argument.
Just
here's the feed and by the way, what's going on?
At that point, the kayakers had been pulled out of the water because the conditions were so bad that they actually couldn't keep up.
Wow.
And over there, they've got some really experienced kayakers.
The
wife of the skipper, a lovely lady called Shelley, she coaches the US Olympic kayak team. So she gets, like, you know, people from there to come and help, and they couldn't keep up.
Wow.
So they got hoisted out of the water, and you've got this boat sitting ahead and me here, so you know, there was no opportunity to communicate. I could just see this boat kind of going along, and I'm looking this way thinking, well, there's the beach. Like, why are we not going in? How much further have I got to go? Because, you know, I need to know roughly, you know, how much longer I need to push for and to mentally prepare. And that uncertainty and unknowingness, it was so challenging.
A little bit like COVID. Like the pandemic, just, right? Yeah.
Andy couldn't see what we could see, which was he could see the sand and the beach and the land, but what he couldn't see was the waves breaking onto rocks and things like that. Wow, so it was just clearly not safe. And we've had to go further and further to the next opportunity to be able to touch land.
Yeah.
And so we did get in, and, you know, we got in 56 minutes, I think. And, you know, it was this, you know, the toughest thing in my life.
Wow.
You know, went to hospital afterwards, had a swollen throat.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, got put on a drip, all these different things. And, you know, it was, you know, probably the hardest thing in my life. But at the same time, it was probably the most valuable experience I've ever gone through. And, you know, it was this great opportunity to learn something and to have this experience that you can always draw on moving forward whenever you face adversity.
Absolutely. It's funny, isn't it, how it all gets compressed as well into, like, I mean, if you had a bad day at work, for example, you know, I mean, it's, what is that, like 8 or 9 hours sort of thing? This is 16 hours or thereabouts. Yeah. So it's like equivalent of 2 bad days at work. But it probably felt like a lifetime whilst you're going through it.
Oh, man, it was just never ending.
But, you know, you got there, mate, and congratulations to you. It was fantastic. Now, just before we wrap up, I'm quite keen just to get a little bit of a summary of what a typical week looks like for you. You're doing all these massive swims sort of thing, you know, 20, 30, 40 kilometre swims and those sort of things. How much training do you do in a week, and what does Monday to Sunday look like for you on a typical week, if there is such a thing?
A typical week, it would be probably 7 or 8 swimming sessions a week.
Because I want to copy this, right?
So usually it's 2 hour swimming sessions in the pool. Most of my work's done in the pool. It's just the reason for that. It's more of a controlled environment, and we can do sets that will work certain certain energy zones, and we can focus on particular areas that we want to prepare ourselves for these swims. And then two gym sessions as well. So in the gym, it's not about lifting massive weights or anything. It's more about strengthening ligaments and a lot of the support muscles around the major ones, because you know they're going to be getting used for long periods of time out there in the channel, and we're trying to build up that durability to you know, because they're usually the first things that go or fatigue when you're out there.
And what do those swims look like? So what's a classic Monday, for example, classic Tuesday, or does it vary so much that you don't really have a...
Usually there's quite a lot of aerobic work, but I suppose the main sessions would be a short rest session. So using hundreds as an example, hundreds on 110 or on 115 in a long course pool. So, you know, you touch... you have to turn around on those times. So, you know, it's a lot of the time it's touch and go. But it's just really bread and butter stuff for long distance swimming and building up that aerobic capacity and that engine for those periods of times.
What's your favourite marathon swimming set then, would you say, if there is,
if there is one? Well, I think that is always a good one. I think doing...
So how many hundreds, for example, like how many hundreds constitute a short rest hundred? Session?
Probably around 30 hundreds maybe. 30 so around three to 4Ks of short rest work.
Mm-hmm.
Bearing in mind, I've been doing this for a long time, so I wouldn't just go straight in and do that off the bat. If it's something that you've not been doing before, it's certainly worth incorporating into things, but building up to that. Threshold sessions where you're working in that threshold zone of sort of 40 beats below your max, your max sustainable pace. That's another important session, and I quite like my pull sets.
Pull, okay, yeah. Do you use paddles as well out of interest, or
yeah, usually use a bit of different equipment. I try to mix it up, so pull and paddles, or band only sometimes, or pull and band. Because
what's your experience of swimming with a band? How do you find it helps you?
I feel like it uses different muscles to when you're using paddles and so forth. You know, I never used to do a lot of band only work. It was only really when I moved to Australia, and I was terrible.
The Aussies love it over here.
The Aussies love it.
They love it. No, we don't.
Jay's got a strong leg kick, so he wouldn't like his band.
It's allocated to you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm at the back of the line. We've got bands.
Speaking from my own experience, we used to do a lot of band-only work when I was, when I first moved over here 10 years ago, and it really transformed my freestyle and
it
built that ability to, I had to rate up quite a lot more in my freestyle swimming so that my legs weren't sinking down, and helped me to kind of develop the core strength and the core muscles to keep a good body position on the surface of the water. So I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, the band only, but I do personally think there's value to it. But, it's different for everyone, you know. Band only, I wouldn't be going into that if you don't have much experience with it. For me, I'd been swimming most of my life, so I had quite a lot of experience before really taking it on and incorporating it into the program. But if you're used to doing mileage and working the shoulders, you know, maybe it's something to consider.
Absolutely. So then just finally then, Andy, let's try to sort of bring this together, and Jay as well, of course. Why do you swim now? Why are you doing this challenge, to maybe reiterate some of the stuff with respect to the, you know, the Black Dog Institute? What does it mean for you right now? What do you think it's going to mean if you're successful in completing the last two?
So I think for me, you know, it's the reason I swim right now. I think one of the things I rediscovered when I got back into it in COVID, you've got the usual things, like it's great for your health. I think for your mental health, it's fantastic, you know, having the endorphins of exercise, but also being immersed in community. I think that's been such an important thing, and you know, connecting with
and you've got a massive fan base, mate, over here, I have to say. No, you do, genuinely, you really? Do, you do, yeah, absolutely. Everyone speaks super highly of you, mate, and such a nice guy, and it's been, you know, it's been great chatting with you,
very,
with you here
very
on this and stuff. It really is genuinely great to actually have you here going through this with everybody. So in terms of how can people get involved with this? I've got a, if you're watching this via YouTube, we've got a link up there for the Black Dog Institute. You're trying to raise 100,000 Australian. I think you're at about 20,000 at the moment.
20 or so at the moment. And, you know, we hopefully can get that a bit higher. And, you know, I think once the challenge is done, I'll have a bit more time to kind of feed up to host some
to
events
bit,
and
yeah.
really push that.
But
yeah, I mean, it's been a journey that I think a lot of people have, what we've tried to do is, you know, try bring as many people along the journey as possible and be quite open about it and share the experiences, not just the highs, but the lows as well. And, you know, hopefully people can view what we're doing and can take a few things away from it and learn.
Well, I mean, just those examples of, you know, the Cook Strait, the amazing world record, the challenges that we went through with Molokai, you know, there are two highs and lows, you know, right there within the space of a few months.
We're just people like everyone and, you know, that's what can happen. And, you know, anyone experiencing those experiences, it's, you know, you're not alone. It happens to people and, you know, there are ways to be able to push through.
And as you said at the very beginning as well, not many people seem to talk about, or there's not a lot of information out there about marathons.
No, there's not. No,
so, you know, the more that, you know, Andy and I can talk to people and to kind of just share our experiences. I don't want to tell anybody how to suck eggs because we all kind of know what we're doing, but share those experiences because the people that have done them before have experienced very similar things. So why they don't choose to share them, I don't know. Maybe... who knows?
It's
nice to talk about these things because there's so many other people coming along that
for
want
sure.
to do them as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. It's becoming, you know, you saw this wave in Ironman and half Ironman triathlon where a lot of the guys who were racing Olympic distance, you know, they started to get close to retirement and thought, you know, I'll race up a distance or do half Ironman, do an Ironman. And it was almost like a bit of an afterthought for people towards the end of their career. Whereas now, obviously, with the 10K marathon swim being an Olympic event and has been since Beijing in 2008, it's really cool to see, you know, really truly fast guys like yourself now coming through the ranks and actually doing these marathon events, putting them on truly on the map of with the Ocean 7 sort of thing and setting some absolutely phenomenal times. And I think that the whole level, I mean, I know you're not doing it specifically for the performance side of things, but it definitely helps to raise the bar a little bit. And,
and that was one of the reasons of doing it the way that Andy's
doing it,
try and raise that profile.
Totally,
Get the word out there that these swims are there and available to people and, you know, I think we've all done marathon swims. It's something that's enriched all of our lives. You know, there's nothing quite like that feeling of
being knackered.
Well, and justifying some
scones. We're going to chow down on those scones in a moment.
I was going to say, one of the absolute benefits of marathon swimming is you can eat
whatever you want. Sometimes you have to eat more than you want.
Absolutely.
So I just put the weight on and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, gents, it's been awesome having you on. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank
Andy Donaldson.
So
Jay,
mate.
Thanks for coming
Pleasure.
In and having a bit of a chat with us. Make sure you check out the links within the YouTube channel there. If you listen to this on the podcast later on, I'll put it in the show notes and stuff. But gentlemen, it's been great having you on. Thanks very much for sharing your journey. And all the best for the last two swims.
Yeah, wicked.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks
catch you later. Cheers. Thank you.